In the studio with me this morning, I have Dr. Jane Kelsey, a lecturer from Auckland University, and she is here to talk about the World Trade Organization, globalization, and the challenges that humanity face. Good morning, Jane. Lovely for you to come to the station today.
It's lovely to be here, Tim.
Thank you. Jane is a professor of law at Auckland University and board member of ARENA, Action Research and Educational Network of Aotearoa. Her main work over the years has been on New Zealand's neoliberal policies, Rogernomics et al., Treaty of Waitangi, decolonialisation and globalisation. And she has written many books on these topics. She is active on behalf of ARENA in the international network known as Our World is Not for Sale, and heading to Hong Kong this weekend for a meeting to plan opposition to the World Trade Organization ministerial meeting there in December. Her recent research has been to write reports for Pacific NGOs and churches on the role Australia and New Zealand are playing in bullying the Pacific Islands into signing free trade agreements that will devastate them. Needless to say, she is no favourite of the New Zealand government. Welcome, Jane. So, Jane, you've endeavoured to bring the debate on globalism to the community at large by attending conferences and scrutinising organisations such as the World Trade Organization and its affiliates, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and of course how they operate, what and who they are affiliated to, and how corporations are doing business, with privatisation still continuing and thus resulting in the loss of the global commons. Where does this leave the 6.4 billion of humanity? Of course, in the supposed democratic West, how are we going to find solutions and thus bring about sustainability and a future of peace?
Well, I think the good thing is that people now are expressing their doubts about the good news model of globalisation that's been peddled pretty aggressively for a number of years. And we've seen a sense of crisis in the international arena in the various institutions. For those who've been following the World Trade Organization, they'll remember what's referred to as the Battle of Seattle back in 1999 when the meeting there was under siege. And then again in 2003, the meeting collapsed, partly because of internal frictions, but also because of mass mobilizations outside of largely South American peasants and trade unionists and other activists, students, and where the Korean farmer Lee Kyung-hai killed himself in protest against what the World Trade Organization meant for the livelihoods of farmers. So we've seen fightbacks at those symbolic occasions, but also much more broadly when I travel around the world in various places, mainly talking to activist groups, but also increasingly to people who are doing critical research. There's quite a widespread, not simply scepticism, but optimism that things are beginning to change. The dilemma is we don't see that quite so much within this country. The government's pretty well got the propaganda machine going. The media, whether it's the television with its 30-second sound bites or 6-second sound bites, or Radio New Zealand and the commercial radio stations, or the newspapers, it's pretty uncommon to see any sustained critique of this. So people in this country really have very little idea about just how strong the resistance internationally is.
Is that because, essentially, again, the media is not focusing on it? I remember in December, there was a United Nations conference on global weather patterns or global warming, and of course there's 6,000 delegates there, and for that whole week or 10 days there was not one thing on New Zealand's television, be it TV3 or Television 1.
Yeah, there are several reasons why we don't hear about these things. One is that I think our media is very lazy. The journalists have to do the research for themselves, have to find a New Zealand angle on a story, And often when it looks for that angle, it's very parochial. It's sort of what Helen did or didn't do, rather than the issues themselves. And when you go to other countries and you look at the depth of the media coverage on these issues, it really reinforces how shallow the debates are here. But there's also in the political arena very little debate. The Green Party's really the only one that raises questions, and all the other opposition parties gang together, if you like, to present a pretty solid line. There's relatively few academics. We don't have the critical think tanks that many other countries have that are able to generate that. So a group like ARENA produces quite a lot of we think high quality analysis and critique, but the resources aren't there to be able to get it out in a very populist way that affects and connects with people's lives. So we don't have the mechanisms in this country that exist in a number of others to be able to counter the dominance of the mainstream media and mainstream politics and academia and so on.
Yes, Jane, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization, of course, wield tremendous power and influence, but, of course, exclude the voices of developing countries most adversely affected by financial and trade policies. Money rules at the World Bank and the IMF, and consensus at the World Trade Organization is often the product of behind-the-scenes bargaining. And the pressures from trade heavyweights such as the United States. How has this been addressed now? I've just noticed very recently out of Durban there's a group there that are pushing for change there, and they've got a lot of people on the ground, particularly through Africa. Can you sort of...
Well, there are a lot of regional initiatives happening in many places. For example, up in Asia, there's an Asian Peasants coalition that's bringing together grassroots farmers, those that are subsistence farmers, those that are very small-scale farmers who are trying to defend their livelihoods against agribusinesses. And the agribusinesses, which include the likes of Alfonterra and Nestle and others, are running totally ecologically unsustainable GE-based, highly water-intensive activities for export, and that threaten the livelihoods of those small farmers. And in fact, they're part of a bigger coalition called the Via Campesina, which is an international peasants movement mobilising in different countries, including small farmers in Europe and North America, who suffer the same pressures from agribusinesses. We're seeing also some really interesting international campaigns around the patenting and seed issues. The Indian communities have been probably the leaders in that, in the defence of traditional seeds, but also in Mexico, the protection of biodiversity and the fear that there is that the dumping of GE grain from the US will contaminate the traditional feed, traditional grain stocks there. And we see really quite nasty things happening in Africa around that, where the US is saying that governments that are refusing to have GE-based food aid are responsible for starving their people, whereas they're concerned about the broader long-term impacts of allowing GE in. And then I suppose the big water campaigns are amongst the biggest mobilisers. And there are several ways those campaigns are running. In part, it's traditional communities running water systems the way that they have for millennia, and insisting that that's the only ecologically sustainable way to do it. But there's also big battles around water privatisations, about the way that the big companies are now buying up control of water, partly to sell as bottled water. So you'll see Coca-Cola or Nestle owning the main water supplies in various countries, but also for their own industrial purposes. I mean, Coca-Cola wants not only water to sell as water, but water so that it can sell Coca-Cola, and Coca-Cola cheaper than people can buy water. Other companies like Monsanto have made it quite clear that they see the control of water as part of giving them control of the whole food cycle, because water is equally critical to be able to run the mass grains that they profiteer from in plantations wherever they're growing for export. And so there have been huge water mobilisations directed against the World Trade Organization and the European Union, the Trade and Services Agreement. The European Union has water amongst the top of its priorities, so it wants commitments from governments to guarantee that foreign firms can come in and run their water supply. Similar campaigns against the World Bank when it's running privatisation of water or the contracting out of water. But also campaigns to kick out the companies when they take control and then they run down the water supply. And the most classic example of that has been the Cochabamba mobilisations in Bolivia, where the government was forced to take back the privatised water company and take back control of it. And Bechtel, which is the US parented company that had the contract, is now trying to sue still the Bolivian government, one of the poorest governments in the world, for multi-millions of dollars. Now, all of these are quite inspirational campaigns. It doesn't stop the power brokers and the institutions of the IMF or the World Bank from running pretty aggressive campaigns, and it doesn't stop the companies from continuing to try to seize the moment. But the balance is shifting.
Yes, I have heard a few news items coming through, particularly out of the States there, that there's a lot of the large companies or corporations in the States are softening, becoming more transparent, and they need to. However, what about how is New Zealand affiliated to all this? Where do we play? Because I know that we've actually sort of cuddled up a lot with the big guys on this, and I can't understand who gave New Zealand permission, particularly as our politicians are supposedly our servants.
One of the dilemmas about the international arena is that governments operate in that sphere in an executive capacity. Because it's not a domestic policy decision, it's not a domestic piece of legislation, it doesn't have to go through the parliament. An international treaty is treated as an act of state, which means that the cabinet effectively can make decisions about what the negotiating position will be, who we'll cuddle up to, what we'll sign, and it doesn't need to go anywhere near the parliament. The only time it has to go near the parliament in terms of any sort of vote is if changes have to be made to our laws to bring us into line with an international treaty. Now, because of the history we have in this country of mass privatisations and mass deregulation, there's not an awful lot more that we have to do to participate in the global marketplace. And even, you know, contracting out of various services can be done without any changes to our laws. So what our governments tended to do is to treat this as a secret set of negotiations which only the cabinet has a say over, but in the process makes commitments that lock us in so that we can't go back on these neoliberal policies of the past. Now, that's one explanation for how they play and how it's anti-democratic. But a second is that when it comes to the international trade arena, our government is fixated on three things: agriculture, and agriculture, and agriculture.
No.
And it will trade anything off for the slightest promise or whiff of a promise that someone might do something to open up markets to New Zealand's agriculture. And it has reached the stage now where there doesn't have to be any empirical evidence that there might be any sort of real tangible gain. Simply to keep the momentum going on this particular agenda, where in theory governments should open their doors to our products, just to keep that bicycle moving forward, they will keep playing the game. And so we're now locked on this to mix the metaphors, merry-go-round of trade negotiations simply because they're terrified of the merry-go-round stalling or the bicycle getting wobbly and falling over. And so we've got all these bilateral negotiations and regional negotiations and negotiations with China and ASEAN and Chile and Mexico and Egypt now, as well as the World Trade Organization, simply because of the ideological commitment to free trade and the belief that somehow New Zealand agriculture will win. And so they will trade off anything to keep that momentum going, and they will make friends with the most evil parts of the evil empire for that to occur.
Well, how do we, the people, get back, get our power back? How do we uncouple this? I mean, surely there has to be, I mean, we've talked about referendums and making them binding. I mean, what do we do? Do we just allow somebody to, in an ad hoc relationship, throw everything away?
Well, the most important thing is for people to understand, firstly, what's happening and how it affects us.
Mm.
How it affects us here, but also how it affects our ethical and moral responsibilities to the rest of the world. That involves education work. It involves basic talking. We've done quite a lot of work with trade unions talking about the impacts, for example, of education, of what's called trade in education services, which is basically what they call the export education industry, bringing as many foreign students in as we can simply for the revenue purposes, nothing to do with education. And so the whole of our education policy gets distorted by the desire to have increasing numbers of students. Now, they're predominantly Chinese students. What happens when it falls over? And why is our government so uncritically embarking down the path of education exports? Well, the education unions have been starting to engage in that question, and we just had a meeting in Melbourne last week with the Australian unions to talk about joint approaches to China and the China free trade negotiations that are about to begin on both countries. And we talked in the education sector, but we also talked, for example, about what happens for the clothing factories. Now, we might think that all our imports come from China now, and so what's the point? But there's still about 18,000 workers in New Zealand who work in the clothing factories, and they're mainly women, and they're mainly Māori, Pacific Islands, and migrant women workers, and they're on the minimum wage, and they have very little bargaining power, but often they're the only wage into families in small towns like Levin. So what happens when those fall over? You know, those are real questions for our local communities. And so when we talk about opposing the China agreement, it's a question of mobilising those local communities. And there are many other examples of that sort as well. And part of our challenge is how we package what can be a really abstract, esoteric, theoretical debate that's way out there and seems just far too big for anyone to get a grip on, and bring it to the local level and get people to demand of their MPs in the Labor government or the national government, well, what on earth are you doing here? And who are you representing? Or getting letters into the local papers, or little articles into the local papers, or even having a picket outside some, you know, local iconic place. You know, just to get increased awareness going. Because unless we start building those connections on the ground and people understanding the connections to their lives, then I don't think we'll impact on the government at all.
Yes, well, we know that 70% of New Zealanders were against GE, and of course that's always stung us. It's quite interesting because possibly there had Helen stayed in as a lecturer in university, she might have been sitting down with you, agreeing with you, had she not gone into politics. Maybe?
She was always a pretty wily disciple of some pretty wily professors of politics at the University of Auckland, so who knows?
I see. Well, look, just going back into the big picture for a moment, a number of World Bank employees, including the former chief economist Joseph Stiglitz, publicly criticised both the World Bank and the IMF, and their voices add credibility to an insider perspective to basically worldwide opposition to the destructive orthodoxies of the two institutions. And of course, in response, the bank has attempted to censor several leading employees and contractors who deviate from the neoliberal models of growth, trade liberalisation and privatisation. Now, I mean, we had our Mike Moore. He was in there for a wee while. How do they work us? I mean, how do they get together? They have these meetings in Davos, and then you hear of different other sort of secretive meetings where they all get together and discuss how basically the world economy is going to run. I mean, you've got the G7 with Russia hanging in on it as well. Now, these different, shall we say, undemocratic organisations, what is their plan?
Well, I'm not a fan of the grand conspiracy theory. There are, if we look over the history of industrial capitalism, a whole series of different waves of economic orthodoxies, right? And the one that we've been going through, the sort of neoliberal globalisation one, has been, you know, started up around mid to late 70s and now is facing its own internal contradictions because it doesn't work, but also contradictions because the voices of orthodoxy, the intellectuals, are expressing doubts, whether they're those within the institutions or those outside. But we shouldn't get too carried away with people like Joe Stiglitz. Yes, he's asking questions, and that's important, but he's also not asking the kind of questions that we might want him to be asking. So we need to celebrate in a way the fact that there is internal dissent, but we need to look critically at what the messages of dissent are. There is also a sort of common platform that we see now embraced by the institutions that grew up during this period. Of course, the IMF and the World Bank existed since the Bretton Woods meetings in the mid-1940s. But they embraced this model in terms of structural adjustment programs from the late 70s, early 80s. Then the World Trade Organization came along in 1995, building onto what was the old GATT, a whole new trade agenda. So we had the three of them, the triumvirate of the IMF, World Bank and World Trade Organization, engaging in what is referred to as coherent economic policy making. And the goal of the World Trade Organization is basically to get governments to lock into place the policies that the IMF and the World Bank promote. So it's meant to try to put an end to the fact that these cycles of orthodoxies come and go and make this the only one forever. And it strikes a problem because if it doesn't work, and it's not working, and if people have doubts, then you have a crisis of legitimacy for the institutions that are claiming this is the only way to go. And that's what we're starting to see happen now, not only with the World Bank and the IMF, but especially in the World Trade Organization. You made mention before to the supposed consensus-based decision-making in the WTO, which is quite different from the IMF and World Bank. And the IMF and World Bank, the major shareholders, which are the big rich countries, are the ones that, by the legal instruments of those organisations, have the majority votes. In the WTO, in theory, every country is equal, which means the poorest countries of the world are the majority. And in theory, they can say no. Now, in practice, we know that power politics doesn't work like that. And they're already on the back foot because they were bullied into agreeing to a whole lot of agreements that are going to be very difficult to turn back. But we are starting to see now real problems that they are, some of them are stamping their feet and some of them are resisting some things. And the consequence of that is that the World Trade Organization looks increasingly fragile. And there's real fear amongst its celebrants that it is not, in fact, going to move forward in the way they wanted, which is why we're seeing all of these little fractures now of the US going off and negotiating a whole lot of free trade agreements with various people, and the European Union doing that, and New Zealand desperately saying, please, someone will talk to us, please, please, we'll talk to anybody who wants to talk to us, because we fear being left out. And this is part of the crisis that's now infecting that model. So on the one hand, it looks as if, yes, they're all getting together and plotting how to run the world to meet their interests, whether it's the corporations or the superpowers. But on the other hand, there's this real fracturing and insecurity and instability that we're seeing emerging. And the job of us as critics is to find ways that we can, what we call, monkey wrench. I don't know if you think back to the old Luddites, when the Luddites used to throw the spanner in the works, you know, to jam up the machine. What we do now is that we look for the monkey wrench or the spanner to throw in the works that can help jam up the machine a bit more.
Yes, well, I know the Brazilians came together with the Indians and the Chinese, and that was a big spanner in the works. And, of course, it was actually a huge spanner because of their combined populations, sort of.
Yeah, but it's a bit of a problem as well, because what we had seen starting to happen was what we call the Global South coming together, which is the bigger developing countries, so-called, and the poorest, least developed countries working together to say no. And they formed various coalitions, sometimes fortuitously and sometimes actively. And that was a very important factor in the Cancun ministerial meeting of the WTO collapsing. But since then, the bigger South countries, India, Brazil, China, have been going off on their own, and they've been invited to the table. And so the question now is, what happens to the littlies? Mm. And where is their voice if they're not able to rely on the big, more powerful countries of the South? And that's going to be a very critical question at the Hong Kong ministerial meeting in December of this year.
Yes, because the Africans, of course, came together very well for a while, and this is a big one now, of course, with the British. The Africans are wanting debt relief. And I know that there was an agreement, a tacit agreement, that possibly that they would relieve all debt up to 100% at one stage, but they're putting it on hold all the way through. And, of course, they can just continue this to make this promise, I presume.
Well, it's old colonial practices. Part of the work that I'm doing at present is in the Pacific Islands, where you got some of the poorest, smallest, most vulnerable countries in the world. And, you know, on the one hand, they've got Australia and New Zealand demanding a free trade agreement with them, as if they need more of our mutton flaps. But also the European Union, which, like Australia and New Zealand, historically gave preferences to the Pacific Islands to send their products into Europe or into Australia and New Zealand without tariffs, so that they could sell more of the little amount of stuff they exported. Now the European Union is saying to the Pacific Islands and to the Caribbean and the African countries, what known as the ACP countries, that they're not going to continue with those preferences. It has to be two-way traffic now. So if the Pacific Islands are going to keep exporting their stuff into European markets, then they have to accept European goods without tariffs on into the Pacific. Now, not just goods, but services, including water and maritime and so on, and investment. Europe's not actually very interested in the Pacific, but it's having to deal with this because it really is more interested in Africa. And it's this old colonial relationship that is now moving into a different role. And Europe still remains as dominant as it was, but it sets the terms of this relationship. But it links together aid and debt and trade in a single package. And it basically says your future lies in globalization. And we will only engage with you and allow your preferences to continue into our countries if you decide to embrace the global economy. Now,
what can they do?
Talking about Tonga, Samoa, Niue, Kiribati, I mean, goodness gracious. And so it is a recolonization through a different ideology, a different formula, but it's the same old power politics that has with it also a foreign policy dimension, and which is really a very pernicious agenda. And you know, it's hard enough when we look at how we fight that kind of agenda here, but there's very little capacity in the governments in the Pacific Islands or in the Caribbean or many African countries to analyse what's happening here, the technicalities to engage in the negotiations, let alone to be able to generate alternatives and to develop other strategies. And very little capacity amongst people's movements on the ground as well. And that, I think, is one of the really serious concerns for us in the Pacific.
I can imagine. Very tired, very poor, haven't got the education, surviving, doing their best to put up with the European Union coming down their back. Yes.
Well, the Pacific's actually more concerned about Australia and New Zealand. And their dilemma is that they got pushed into signing an agreement with Australia and New Zealand called PACER, which basically says when the islands negotiate something with the European Union, they also have to negotiate with Australia and New Zealand. And they're not that fussed about the European Union because there's not much trade there, so the impact of allowing Europe's goods into the Pacific is going to be quite limited. But you think about offering the same to Australia and New Zealand, and the potential for the deluge of local food markets and fish markets and local services and local construction and education sectors and so on to be deluged by Australia and New Zealand is pretty high. And most of those islands in the Pacific get their revenue to run their social services and their infrastructure and their state sector from tariffs. And if the tariffs have to go, then their revenue goes. And the idea of our government's peddle is that, oh, this is going to create a whole rush of economic activity in the islands because they're going to face the pressures of efficiency and competition, and there'll be new foreign investors who come in and help bring the economies to life. Now, I mean, that's flying pig territory. That's never going to happen. And if they can't generate that economic activity locally, then how are they going to do it? A VAT? Well, I mean, you can only tax people's food and basics so much. And it seems, in fact, that the main way that they're going to compensate is by sending more of their skilled and unskilled workers offshore to send remittances home. And that's going to hollow out the skill base
as well as
the communities themselves. Mm-hmm. And so the unthinking ideological approach of globalization and claiming that the islands have to inject themselves into this is a real dilemma. And we need to ask serious questions of our governments about what they're doing, because it won't just affect the economic and social life in the Pacific and the ecosystems in the Pacific and those communities here. It'll affect the stability and the security of the Pacific, as we've seen in the Solomons and we've seen in PNG. And greater instability in the Pacific is going to cause real issues for us here too.
And because we need some solutions, I wish to know if you can sort of cut through here and give us a few ideas as to get us to make a move, particularly if this is an election year. Let's see what we can do.
Well, there aren't any simple single answers to this. There are many different ways that people can participate and have their voices heard. And that depends a lot on the kinds of activities people are engaged in, the kinds of networks and communities that they're a part of. One of the simplest starting points is for people to start working together again. Because of the pressures of recent years, because of the financial pressures many communities are under, because of the loss of the 40-hour working week, the fact that people are working all hours of the day and all days of the week, we really have had a breakdown of many of our community organisations. And so many of the things we would have fought against years ago actually now just go by default. And for people to start at the local level simply resisting things that they think are wrong and unfair, whether that's the closure of a school or whether that's the establishment of a warehouse that's going to rely on predominantly imported products and drive out local shops from business, whether it's plans of the local council to contract out more of its services to an international company. You know, those kinds of local level challenges are really important and they can make a difference. And networking of people who are fighting those battles in different parts of the country can make a difference. For example, those who are doing battles with local government. And you know, the water privatisation lobby has been extremely active, but there are many others. Toll roads.
Yes.
Toll roads are going to be absolutely critical. And the toll roads are going to increasingly be controlled by public-private partnerships or private finance initiatives of foreign companies who will get guarantees through secret contracts that are entered into that we won't know what they are, but I can guarantee you there'll be a bailout clause there that if they don't make a profit that local government will top it up. Now we need to get in on the ground before those things become established and say they're not acceptable. And there are many different ways people can express their voices on that, whether it's simply letter writing or attending meetings or pickets or whatever. At another level, many people are involved in groups and organisations that do have a voice. And some of them have expressed views and concerns around these issues. For example, those who are involved in nursing have been very concerned about plans for private companies to come in and take over hospitals and rest homes, and we're seeing that now with the childcare centres and so on as well. So those who are involved at community levels in areas like childcare or a range of aged care facilities, what we're going to see is the big chains taking over, pushing out the local operators, and those chains will just treat the school kids or the preschool kids or the elderly as figures on a balance sheet. And so to draw those connections through those kinds of activities. There's been quite a strong move amongst Māori in areas of intellectual property rights and patenting of biodiversity, whether it's been human genetic material or animal genetic material or plant material. And so the linkages there across with others, with non-Māori who are fighting those battles, are very important. Those who are developing alternatives in the organic sector, I think organics are going to be a really growing phenomenon, even if it's only the middle class who get to buy them because they're more expensive. But to promote the organics movement as a viable, sustainable alternative to the kind of Fonterra model of agriculture that's being promoted is a really viable approach.
I mean, I still run a veggie garden, and the crop of potatoes that we've had, which are the old Māori potatoes, are just stunning, and they'll keep us going for the whole year. And this is in Mount Wellington. You know, it's good soil, but it's a little suburban plot. But on the agriculture sector as well, one of the areas I think that we often think is a lost cause here is the farming sector. And I spoke earlier last year at the National Council of Women conference on trade and environment in a workshop, and what I was talking with them about was the issues affecting farming communities. And what we're seeing overseas is that our Fonterra, for example in Chile where I was recently, has joined forces with Nestle and is operating a strategy to dominate the milk market in South America. And the small-scale farmers can't survive there. It's only the big corporate farmers who are the ones who can meet the standards Fonterra is demanding, but also produce at a scale that they can afford to sell at the price Fonterra will pay. And there is a sort of romantic sense in New Zealand that our farmers are the little plot farmers that we used to have, but the small-scale farmers are increasingly giving way to the same corporate farmers. And even though Fonterra at present doesn't have tradable shares and Nestle can't therefore take control of Fonterra, the more corporate farmers we have, the more their interests are going to be tied into having Fonterra as a big conglomerate with tradable shares. And as soon as we have that happen, then we will have the likes of Nestle entering into a joint venture ownership with Fonterra or taking a majority holding. And New Zealand local farmers and local farming communities will be in the same position that small contract farmers are in other parts of the world. Now, those are very real stories that we can start having discussed. And when you talk with women in farming communities, they can see it happening already. And so the sustainability of their communities, as well as of our food security, is a really serious question. And so I think, you know, all those levels, they're not levels even that requires you to engage with government. You know, they're levels about building awareness and understanding and local level resistances that then are the kind of battles we can take to local MPs and say to them, no, we're not going to be fobbed off by your arguments that we don't understand. I mean, because it's actually the fact that the MPs don't understand. They don't have debates on these issues. And very few cabinet ministers actually understand these issues either. They leave it to Jim Sutton and the trade wonks, as they're known in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And so to force the MPs into becoming educated themselves, to force them to come along to local meetings where they have to engage in the debates about what's happening in the local communities, those are real options. So, yeah, it's just a start.
Just a start. Well, you sound very optimistic all the same, because we've just got to keep the pressure on. And New Zealanders can't take a back seat on this one. We've all actually got to be right up there. Comfortably numb is not the way to get through this. Jane, thank you very much for coming here and sharing with us today. It's been enlightening. We definitely realise that the whole global community is on a huge change at the moment. And of course, with the population still expanding and the pressures are on, we have to be alert 24/7. So once again, thank you very much.
That's my pleasure.
That was Jane Kelsey, Professor of Law, Auckland University.